Chapter 1. A Base Camp for the Gods. What would you say if I told you there is a place 13,000 feet high up in the Andes that, according to ancient Inca traditions, was built in a single night by the gods? A place where huge stone slabs lie strewn around like discarded playing cards on the floor. Stone slabs that have been carefully cut and transported, and yet about which the Spanish chroniclers, writing 400 years ago, said that no man could have moved. A place where gigantic blocks of andesite were cut and worked with incredible precision, and archaeologists expect us to believe that it was Stone Age men that did it? A place in which a calendar was discovered that reaches back 15,000 years into the past. A calendar that even shows the phases of the moon for every day and every hour. Let me tell you, this place really exists. It's called Tiwanaku, and it lies high in the Bolivian Andes. So why have we never heard of this place? Why hasn't National Geographic or the Discovery Channel produced groundbreaking documentaries about it? Is there some sort of conspiracy going on? Or has this sensational discovery simply gone up in a puff of smoke? One of the reasons for this deafening silence is a friend of Adolf Hitler and well-known anti-Semite named Hans Horbiger, an eccentric of the kind that only recognizes one truth, his own. People like this are never written about, even when they occasionally come up with extremely valid points. So just who was this guy? Hans Horbiger was born in 1860 to a well-to-do family in the Tyrol region. He studied engineering at the Technical University in Vienna, and after graduating, worked initially as a technical draftsman at a factory building steam engines. Eventually, he transferred to the land company, where he worked as a compressor specialist. In 1894, he devised a new valve system for pumps and compressors. He patented his new invention and licensed it to a number of German and foreign firms. For a while, it made him quite a rich man, but much of his fortune was wiped out, first by the hyperinflation of the 20s and subsequently the Second World War. As a young engineer, Horbiger one day observed molten steel flowing over a blanket of snow. It struck him how the snow and earth veritably exploded due to the heat of the steel. It gave him a quite interesting idea. What if the same process were taking place in a kind of eternal struggle throughout the entire universe? Ice and fire, life and death. Horbiger postulated that throughout the cosmos, huge heavenly bodies would be constantly colliding with mighty chunks of ice and consequently exploding. The resulting debris would form planets and moons. This was the basis of the world ice theory that Hans Horbiger published in 1913. According to this world ice theory, our Earth has harbored numerous highly developed cultures that existed in various geological ages, before today's moon even came into existence. These cultures were always destroyed when mighty boulders approached from space and exploded in our atmosphere. The debris that thundered down onto the Earth has caused such catastrophes as the flood and the downfall of Atlantis. In Horbiger's opinion, mankind was already highly civilized in the tertiary era. The moon that arose during the tertiary crashed down to Earth, according to Horbiger, 25,000 years ago, causing all of the lands in the tropics to flood, with the exception of a few high peaks in the Andes and Ethiopia. Hans Horbiger was a wrathful prophet indeed, and he certainly had the look for it. He wore his white beard long and had a permanently fierce expression. On top of that, he had handwriting that was virtually unreadable. Rather egocentrically, he viewed himself as one of the world's great scholars and the only one who proclaimed the truth. Accordingly, he demanded radical recognition from the scientific community of the mid-1920s. His way of thinking was much like Hitler's, and vice versa. In his unholy zeal, Horbiger tolerated no opposition, damning the mathematical and astrophysical knowledge of the times as worthless lies. Hitler and Horbiger. In the scientific and technology-fixated world of pre-war Germany, Hans Horbiger blazed his trail with a mixture of dogmatism, brute force, and alleged enlightenment. Together with his students, he began agitating among the circles of the intelligentsia. Lacking any sort of scruples and utterly immune to criticism, he invested some of his not insubstantial wealth to set up a movement that was made up of paying members and also had its own small elite troop unit. Adherents plastered the walls of universities and sports stadiums with posters, and handbills were distributed by the thousand. Lectures held by astronomers who disagreed with Horbiger's opinions were disrupted with boos and ironic laughter, and professors were badgered on the streets. Horbiger wrote to well-known engineers and astronomers, "Either you must learn to believe in me, or I must treat you as my enemy." The Horbiger movement published a total of 3 extensive reference works and 40 further books aimed at a wider audience. Not only that, there were countless pamphlets and brochures. Their monthly magazine, Der Schlüssel zum Weltgeschehen, The Key to World Events, achieved a circulation of 100,000 copies. Hitler believed in Horbiger and supported him publicly. They also met many times. Hitler listened avidly to Horbiger's lectures, even though the irascible Horbiger wouldn't allow even the Führer to interrupt. In one of the pamphlets the group published at the time, one can read, "One Austrian, Hitler, banished the Jewish politicians. A second Austrian, Horbiger, will banish the Jewish scientists too." Louis Powell and Jacques Bergier, 2 great French thinkers and journalists, wrote about Horbiger's teachings. "Horbiger claims that he can reveal the truths about our planet's earliest history as well as its distant future. He throws all current theories on the history of cultures, the appearance and development of mankind and his societies, simply out of the window. Hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of years ago, he maintains, there already existed godlike peoples, giants, and highly developed cultures. The entire universe is undergoing a kind of uniform phase of development. It is a living organism in which every part exerts an influence on every other part. The quest of mankind is linked to the quest of the stars. Everything that happens in the cosmos is reflected in events on the Earth, and vice versa." But what has all this got to do with the highlands of Bolivia and mysterious ruined city of Tiwanaku? The answer is that one of Horbiger's followers was an archaeologist, a certain Dr. Edmund Kiss, who spent 9 years carrying out research in the highlands of the Andes. There, in Tiwanaku, a monolithic gateway had been discovered, what is today known as the Gateway of the Sun. For Edmund Kiss, the engravings on this sun gate represented some kind of calendar. It was possible, he claimed, to read the solstices, the equinoxes, every day of the year, the position of the moon for every hour, and all of this data even took into account the rotation of the earth. "The people that invented this calendar belonged to a higher civilization than ours," insisted Kiss. According to his calculations, Tiwanaku was erected around 27,000 years before Christ's birth. This calendar, he maintained, was engraved in the stone by astronomers from the tertiary period and provides us with incontrovertible scientific evidence. Indeed, Horbiger's followers actually did find evidence, in and around Tiwanaku, of some kind of global disaster. For instance, the remains of a large harbor, sea sediments at an altitude of 2.5 miles, volcanic ash mixed in with the mud from a flood of biblical proportions, and even fragments of bones from alleged giants. Not only that, all of these things originated from the time when our previous moon allegedly exploded, initially causing a ring of debris to form around the Earth that subsequently rained down catastrophically upon our planet. And let us not forget that, at least according to Horbiger, this was not the first time. There had been many previous moons and many catastrophes. Horbiger worked out that the amount of time that had elapsed during which the Earth was not orbited by any moon at all was 138,000 years. During that time, giant kings apparently reigned over the earth. Then, around 14,000 years ago, the earth captured our present moon, and yet another catastrophe rolled over our mistreated globe. From the north and the south, the seas flooded into the middle regions of the earth. And in the north, on the plateaus that the newly captured moon had laid bare, the ice ages began. But has Horbiger's world ice theory been completely refuted? Not quite, because giants did live on the earth in days gone by, at least according to ancient records. But for now, let me tell you what I actually know on the subject. Giants roamed the earth. In Christianity's most holy book, the Bible, giants are mentioned as early as the book of Genesis, Genesis chapter 6, verse 4. There were giants on the earth in those days, and also after that, when the sons of God came in to the daughters of men, and they bore children to them. The same became mighty men, who were of old, men of renown. In the fifth book of the Pentateuch, there is even mention of a mighty sarcophagus. For only Og, king of Bashan, remained of the remnant of giants. Behold, his bedstead was a bedstead of iron. Is it not in Reboth of the children of Ammon? 9 cubits was the length of it, and 4 cubits the breadth of it, after the cubit of a man. Deuteronomy chapter 3, verse 11. The Hebrew cubit was equivalent to 19 inches. The same book mentions a people great and tall, the sons of the Anakim, who God plans to destroy with a consuming fire. Deuteronomy chapters 2 and 3. And we've all heard of the famous struggle between David and Goliath. In the Bible, it is described by the prophet Samuel, 1st book of Samuel, chapters 4 through 7. And there went out a champion from the camp of the Philistines named Goliath of Gath, whose height was 6 cubits and a span, and he was armed with a coat of mail, and the weight of the coat was 5,000 shekels of brass, and the staff of his spear was like a weaver's beam, and his spear's head weighed 600 shekels of iron. All but a very few of the gigantic Anakites were driven out by Joshua. No Anakites were left in the land of the Israelites. Only in Gaza, in Gath, and Ashdod did any remain. Joshua chapter 11, verse 22. And, in earlier times, the name of Hebron had been Kiriath Arba, named after Arba, the greatest of the Anakim. Joshua, verse 15. In the first book of Chronicles, the reader can marvel at the story of how the last giant was finally killed, at which time Sibekai the Hushathite slew Sipai, that was of the children of the giant, a man of great stature, whose fingers and toes were 4 and 20, 6 on each hand and 6 on each foot, and he also was the son of the giant. Chapter 8. These were born to the giant in Gath, and they fell by the hand of David and by the hand of his servants. First book of Chronicles, verse 4 and following. Of course, the Bible is not the only source that confirms the existence of giants in previous ages. In the ancient texts on the legends of the Jews, you can read, there were the Emim, or the terrible ones, then the Rephaim, or giants, and also the Geborim, or the violent ones. And giants are also mentioned in the 14th chapter of the book of the antediluvian prophet Enoch, one of the Apocrypha. Here the Most High reproaches his fallen guardians of heaven. Wherefore have ye left the high, holy, and eternal heaven, and lain with women, and defiled yourselves with the daughters of men, and taken to yourselves wives, and done like the children of earth, and begotten giants as your sons? In the Greek saga, the Argonautica, giants are mentioned frequently. Here's an example. On the Capadog Peninsula, the Argonauts unwittingly climb a mountain to get a better view of their position. Heracles and a few men remain on board to guard the Argo. Suddenly, they are attacked by giants. But the monsters are unaware of Heracles, who shoots and kills several of them from a distance with his arrows. Their bodies have 3 pairs of nerved hands, like paws. The first pair hangs from their gnarled shoulders, the second and third pairs nestle up against their misbegotten hips. These monsters crop up in many of the classic Greek sagas and legends. For instance, in Homer's Odyssey, when the hero battles against a giant on the island of the Cyclops and burns out his only eye. Nowadays, walls made of gigantic stone blocks are known as Cyclops walls. Monsters of varying kinds turn up in the Gilgamesh epic that was unearthed in Nineveh, in modern-day Iraq. The ancient clay tablets were part of the library of the Assyrian king Ashurbanipal. The story tells how Gilgamesh and his friend Enkidu climbed the mountain of the gods together. Shortly before they reach their goal, they are confronted by a terrifying being called Humbaba. Humbaba has paws like a lion, his body is covered with iron scales, and his feet are armed with claws. The two brothers in arms shoot arrows at the monster and fling their throw sticks, but everything simply bounces off. The Park of the Gods, too, is guarded by dreadful creatures, namely gigantic scorpion beings. Trembling terror they inspire. The sight of them is death. Their frightening aura sweeps over the mountains. These monsters cannot be any ordinary creatures. They can talk and even give the two friends a stern warning. The Sumerologist Professor Samuel Kramer even translated a passage from one of the cuneiform tablets in which a rape leads to the birth of a giant. Enlil impregnates Ninlil. She rejects his advances, but that doesn't stop Enlil from forcing her to his will. My vagina is too small. She does not understand coitus. My lips are too small. You can also read about primitive giants in the Popol Vuh of the Quiche Maya. They raged among mankind until the god Ahmusenab unleashed a devastating inferno to wipe them out. Some survived and wandered around lost in the dingy twilight. When they came across men, there were desperate skirmishes. The Book of the Eskimos put it succinctly, "In the old days, there were giants on the earth." To be honest, I could go on all day this way. There are quotes about giants in practically all of the ancient texts, regardless of which peoples compiled them. But humor me and let me give you two more examples, as they are more precise than most of the popular legends. In the venerable Book of the Ethiopian Kings, the Kebra Nagast, chapter 100 tells the following. And the daughters of Cain, with whom the angels had coupled, became with child, but were unable to bring forth their children, and they died. And some of the children who were in their wombs died, and some came forth, having split open the bellies of their mothers, and when they grew up and into manhood, they became giants. The most unfathomable statement, however, can be found in the apocryphal book of Baruch. Baruch actually states the number of giants who are said to have lived before the flood. God caused the deluge upon earth and destroyed all flesh, and 409,000 giants. It remains a mystery as to where the venerable author got his figures from. The allusions to giants in the ancient traditions are many and easy to find for those who take the trouble to look. The difficulty is finding actual proof in terms of hard facts. Admittedly, many scientists have claimed to have made finds of giant bones or tools that could only have been made and used by giants, but they all remain controversial. For instance, German paleontologists Gustav von Königswald, 1902 to 1982, and Franz Weidenreich, 1873 to 1948, discovered several giant bones in apothecary shops in Hong Kong and China. Weidenreich even lectured on the subject to the American Ethnological Society in 1944. Hard facts. Professor Denis Seurat, the renowned director of the Centre International d'Etudes Françaises in Nice, found hand axes weighing 8.4 pounds a little less than 4 miles south of Safita in Syria. And in Ain Fritissa in eastern Morocco, he discovered some weighing 9.3 pounds, 12.6 inches long, and 8.7 inches wide. In his expert opinion, axes of this size would only be suitable for use by giants. Sera supports the former existence of giants and even claimed that they could be responsible for the unexplained dolmens and huge menhirs that can be found throughout Europe. He also thought it would account for the superhuman power required to build the Cyclops walls that are dotted around the Mediterranean area. Bones from oversized early men were discovered as early as 1936 by German anthropologist L. Cohn Larsen by Lake Ayasi in Tanzania. He even gave them a scientific name, Meganthropus africanus. Similar finds were made in Java, Meganthropus paleojavanicus. The former delegate of the French Prehistoric Society, Dr. Louis Burkhalter, speaking in an article that appeared in the 1950 Revue du Musée de Beyrouth in Beirut, fully supported these bone findings. I would like to make clear that the existence of giant humanoids in the Acheulean epoch must be considered to be scientifically proven fact. In the middle of the last century, Australian archaeologist Dr. Rex Gilroy, director of the Mount York Natural History Museum in Bathurst, New South Wales, discovered huge prehistoric tools together with a skeleton and a molar tooth measuring 2.3 inches in length and 1.8 inches in breadth. He even found a huge footprint measuring 23.6 by 7.1 inches in the dried-up earth. Dr. Gilroy conjectured that the being that made this footprint would have had to have been 20 feet tall. Another simply impossible finding involving massive footprints was made in Glen Rose, Texas. Here, in the riverbed of the Paluxy River, dinosaur footprints were discovered alongside those of giant human beings, all in the same sedimentary layer. Any anthropologist will tell you that that's just not possible. Dinosaurs and men never lived at the same time. Curiously, in this case, it wasn't just one or two footprints. It was dozens. The direction of the dinosaur's flight is clearly identifiable, and the human footprints follow right behind as if they were chasing the beast. The findings in Glen Rose ignited a heated scientific debate. The evolution theorists were united. Dinosaur footprints and human footprints in the same sedimentary layer? It could only be a forgery, and they even ascribed this fakery to the creationists, those people who, especially in the United States, do not believe in Darwin's theory of evolution, but rather that all life on Earth came about as a result of divine creation. The creationists themselves, on the other hand, vehemently denied that they had had anything to do with it. The amazing thing about this scientific debate was the fact that the very few evolutionists who actually dared to make the trip to the Paluxy River to check out the discovery for themselves often ended up actually changing sides. People and dinosaurs at the same time? Impossible? In recent times, even the impossible seems to have become possible. Renowned evolutionist biologist Professor Robert Martin from the Field Museum of Natural History, Chicago, is convinced that humans and dinosaurs lived at the same time. Humans and other primates evolved around 90 million years ago. Accordingly, the ancestors of gorillas, chimpanzees, and humans lived side by side with the dinosaurs and really only began their evolution after the dinosaurs' extinction. Paleontologist Wolf-Dieter Heinrich from the Berlin Museum for Natural History actually found petrified remains from the late Jurassic period, and he found them in the famous Tendaguru fossil layers in Tanzania, a site known for its dinosaur remains. Professor Martin and his team conducted a number of molecular genetic tests that confirmed the extreme age of the bones. Professor Ulfer Arnesen from the University of Lund in Sweden, also a molecular geneticist, has ascertained that the most important split in the mammalian genealogical tree took place as early as the Mesozoic era. To conclude this short round of observations about giants in prehistory, I would like to share with you a strange story from King Solomon's times. In addition to a number of other women, the wise king, as we know, also had an intimate relationship with the Queen of Sheba, or, as she is also known in Arabic, Balkis. The last meeting between Solomon and the Queen of Sheba took place in Tadmor, the City of Palms. Tadmor was later known as Palmyra, an oasis town in the north of the Syrian desert. The wasteful Solomon had a huge mausoleum erected in the city for his great love. Muhammad al-Hassan, biographer of the Prophet Muhammad, reported that Caliph Walid I, 705 to 715 AD, had found a grave with the inscription, "This is the grave and the bier of the pious Balkis, wife of Solomon." The Caliph had the grave opened. When he saw what was inside, his blood froze, and he ordered that the grave be closed and never again opened. On top of the tomb, he erected a large building as a warning. What on earth had horrified the Caliph so? The tomb of Balkis was the grave of a giant. Maybe the controversial giants of Horbiger's world ice theory were not so spurious after all. He could have taken his information from the ancient records that, after all, were all available in those days. And let's not forget, whether we like it or not, Darwin's evolution never ran as smoothly as his theory would have us believe. In their well-researched 1,000-page work, Forbidden Archaeology, authors Michael Cremo and Richard Thompson document a whole host of anthropological inconsistencies that certainly do not fit in with the idea of linear evolution. The book has, incomprehensibly, been ignored by both archaeo and anthropologists. The preciseness of the sources and proofs, however, is mighty impressive. The origin of the moon? Now, let's not forget that Hans Orbiger also maintained in his world ice theory that there had been several different moons circling around the Earth, and that the current one had only been in orbit for around 14,000 years. The various moons were the real reason for the rise and fall of the many different cultures, he postulated, including the culture from Tiwanaku. Absurd? Don't we have conclusive evidence about the moon and its heritage? After all, Americans have even brought moon rock back home with them, haven't they? Just for the skeptics, I know all those books that claim that the Americans never went to the moon and that the landings shown on TV were nothing but hokum cooked up in the desert and various TV studios. That kind of anti-Americanism is easy enough to disprove. U.S. astronauts deposited a measuring plate on the moon that is, to this day, homed in on via laser from the Earth. It is used to measure the exact distance between the Earth and the moon. And what's more, further moon landings are planned by the Chinese and Japanese. Of course, they will find all the junk left lying around by the Americans on their previous visits. As usual, none of the unbelievers from the Anti-Moon Landing League will bother to apologize to the Americans. I am personally acquainted with several of the men who worked on the NASA moon program, starting with Wernher von Braun, Hermann Oberth, Willy Ley, Harry Rupert, Ernst Stuhlinger, all of them the proud bearers of the title of either professor or doctor, right up to chief engineer Joseph Blumrich. All of them were honorable men, without exception. Not one single one of them would have been involved with any kind of global moon deception. So, do we know how the moon was created, or how old it is? Have Orbiger's fantasies finally been laid to rest? There are a number of theories about the origin of the moon. The fission hypothesis. The rotation of the proto-Earth generated centrifugal forces that flung out a large chunk of its mass into space. This coalesced to form the moon. The many moons hypothesis. Several smaller satellites were caught in the Earth's gravitational field. These collided and formed today's moon. The capture hypothesis. The Earth and the Moon arose independently of each other. At some stage, the Earth caught the Moon in its gravitational field. The co-formation hypothesis. The Earth and the Moon formed together from the primordial gloop at the same time and place, the Moon itself forming from the material surrounding the proto-Earth. The giant impact hypothesis. The Earth collided with the huge Mars-sized body. The matter that was thrown out into space came together to form the moon. Whichever is correct, the latest research from the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology, ETH, and the universities of Oxford, England, Cologne, Germany, and Münster, Germany, all concludes that the moon was created many millions of years ago. How does one come up with such a venerable age? It's all down to the levels of the isotope Wolfram-182, which is formed as a result of the decomposition of the radioactive isotope hafnium. Hafnium decomposes completely in 60 million years. This is a physical fact. Scientists at the Institute for Isotope Geology at the ETH Zurich examined moon rocks that the U.S. astronauts had brought with them back to Earth. They measured minuscule amounts of Wolfram-182, which allowed them to ascertain the age on the basis of decomposed hafnium. The larger the differences in the Wolfram-182, the older the rock has to be. The result was an age of X million years and tends to support the giant impact hypothesis, which states that the Earth and the Moon are two heavenly bodies that collided with each other millions of years ago. Assuming we believe these latest results, then Orbiger was certainly wrong, and our Moon hasn't been orbiting the Earth for only 14,000 years, so it cannot be responsible for the destruction of Tiwanaku. Nevertheless, whether it was the moon or not, it can certainly be shown that the Earth has been hit by abrupt climactic catastrophes in its past. These are revealed by examining sediments or glacial erratics, large chunks of rocks deposited by melting glaciers at the end of the last ice age. The foothills of the Alps are full of them. By the way, those glaciers melted many thousands of years ago without the help of today's greenhouse gases, a fact that is often glossed over in current discussions. There have been even cosmic impacts during Earth's history. Meteorites may have collided with the Earth at certain times or fallen into its oceans and triggered horrendous floods around the world. The only thing is, the cause of all these things, as we now know, cannot have been the moon. So Orbiger's followers will need to think again. There is, however, one point that still remains open, something that Orbiger simply came up with intuitively and that has recently again been the subject of some debate. Orbiger claimed that everything in the cosmos was subject to an overarching process of evolution, that the entire universe was a living organism in which every constituent part has an influence on every other part. And indeed, elementary particles didn't just acquire their confusing characteristics from nowhere, but rather through their interaction with other objects, such as Higgs particles. Particles are, as the word implies, not independent objects. They are a part of something else. Every particle reflects the whole, and the universe consists of particles that it has created itself. This simple truth has led astrophysicists to the, at first glance absurd, question, is the universe a living organism? The universe, a living organism? What, or perhaps even who, is the universe? Is God simply a manifestation of the entire cosmos? Questions like these have been a part of religious philosophy for millennia and were not concocted by Orbiger. In modern astrophysics, the being of the universe is treated just as it is in religion. The difference is, however, that cosmologists do not claim to represent faith, but scientific opinion. Professor Paul Davies, a quantum physicist and cosmologist at the Arizona State University, has published several articles on the subject, as well as controversial books such as The Accidental Universe, The Mind of God, About Time, and The Goldilocks Enigma. Another brilliant exponent of this God is universe hypothesis is the American James Gardner. Talking at international conventions and symposia, he astounds and amazes his listeners with his cool logic and provocative statements, such as the following. Every kid knows that the universe is an environment that is hostile to mankind, but if you look a little bit deeper, you'll see that that's not true. The universe is a very hospitable place. James Gardner begins his presentations with the origin of the universe and proves that this very hospitability was a constituent element of the Big Bang itself. All of the components, which later developed into atoms, subatomic particles, molecules, and even life forms, were already present at the time of the Big Bang. Looking at it from this point of view, the development and proliferation of life forms in the cosmos did not happen on a random basis, but was rather a natural part of universal evolution. The aim of the universe is to fill the entire cosmos with intelligent life. Thus, we continuously observe the birth of new universes. Every black hole that swallows a Milky Way spits it back out again in a new Big Bang somewhere and someone else. There's a kind of cosmic reproduction going on. New baby universes are being born. Highly advanced hyper-civilizations then seed these baby universes with life. This message of life is spreading through the entire cosmos. We humans are simply a part of it. This is one insight that I have shared in many of my books long before I had ever read James Gardner's wonderful research. So where did my insight come from? Well, it's no coincidence, claims the controversial James Gardner. It is the memes that are responsible for this proliferation. Unlike genes, memes are information particles that spread like viruses. Whereas genes pass on hereditary information, DNA, memes transmit information in a more disembodied manner, directly from brain to brain, uninterrupted, day in, day out, and throughout the entire universe. Every time I give a lecture, I infect other brains with my memes. The same thing, dear listener, is happening to you right now as you hear these very words. Horbiger may have scored a few lucky points with his world ice theory. For instance, on the possible existence of giants in the dim and distant past, or the flooding of ancient sites as a result of global catastrophes. But in most other respects, he was way off base. The moon of today has been around for a lot longer than 14,000 years, for instance. Then I ask myself, how did Horbiger come up with the idea that the entire universe is some kind of cosmic life form? That was considered crazy talk back in those days. Was it just his megalomania, or did it have something to do with the memes? The discovery of Tiwanaku. People have been streaming to Tiwanaku for centuries. The earliest reports on the subject came from the Spanish chronicler Pedro Cieza de León, who visited in 1549. Tiwanaku no es pueblo muy grande, pero es mentado por los grandes edificios que tiene. Tiwanaku is not a small village. Rather, it is famous for its grandiose buildings. A short distance from a hill stand two stone statues shaped as men. They are so large that they look like giants, but the thing that elicits the greatest amount of wonder is the size of the stone slabs, which are so huge we cannot understand how men could ever have moved them. Many of these platforms have been worked in various ways. There are also stone slabs with doorways, all made from a single block. We do not comprehend with which tools such work could have been achieved. What's more, the blocks must have been even greater in size before they were worked. No one understands how these great weights could ever have been moved. I have been assured that these constructions were already there before the Inca ruled, and much of what the Inca later erected in Cusco had been inspired by what they had seen in Tiwanaku. In the presence of Juan Vargas, I asked the natives whether these buildings had been erected during the age of the Incas. They laughed and answered, "The buildings had been there for many years before the Incas began their rule." These structures, they assured me, and they knew this with certainty from their forefathers, had been built in a single night, constructed by beings whose provenance they did not know. And may the fame of these things remain intact throughout the universe. Y hacen que vuela la fama de las cosas que suceden por el universo. There were none still living who knew this unearthly sight as anything other than ruins. Some 400 years ago, Garcilaso de la Vega, too, stood before the ruins of the mighty walls and platforms, only some of which remain today. This is because the Bolivians blew up the millennia-old slabs to make stone for building. In Book 1, Chapter 23 of his work on the subject, Garcilaso de la Vega wrote of the inexplicable sight. I looked in wonder at a great wall built of such mighty stones that we could not imagine which earthly power could have been used to accomplish such a feat. The natives maintain that the buildings were there before the Incas. They do not know who the builders were, but know with some degree of certainty from their ancestors that all these wonders were erected in a single night. Juan de Betanzos, another Spanish chronicler of that time, claimed to know that it was the creator Contiki Viracocha who also created the sun, moon, and stars, and in that same night of the people he personally built Tiwanaku. According to this version, the gods, however you wish to interpret that term, were involved in Tiwanaku's construction. One thing all of the chroniclers are agreed on: the mighty complex was built in a single night. In 1572, Cristobal de Molina was working as a priest and doctor in the Indio Hospital in Cusco. He had intensive contact with the indigenous peoples and diligently wrote down all their religious lore. Hans Horbiger could have used his writings as a source for his world ice theory, as Molina wrote that Manco Capac was the first Inca and the flood story was already well known by educated Indios in pre-Christian times. According to their legends, all life had been destroyed and the floodwaters covered even the highest mountains. Only one man and one woman survived the flood in a box. The creator, they said, had delivered this pair to Tiwanaku, where he started to create new animals, fish, and birds. I'd have no problem quoting at least 50 pages from the age of the Spanish conquistadores, and I'd always come to the same conclusion. Anyone who visited the ruins of Tiwanaku 400 years ago and stood in front of neighboring Pumapunku would have felt overawed by the mighty constructions. These days, you might even say overwhelmed. 100 years later, Antonio de Castro y del Castillo, who was Bishop of La Paz in 1651, summed it up perfectly. Although it was once supposed that the ruins had been the work of the Incas as fortresses for their wars, now it is clear that they are, in fact, of antediluvian origin. Had it been the Incas' work, buried so deep, not even the Spanish would have been capable of creating such a wonderful and momentous building. Miguel Balboa, a chronicler and priest who settled in Peru in 1566, wrote that even the Inca Huayna Capac had viewed the ruins of Tiwanaku with awe and wonder. A stony problem. The astonishment and wonder of those men who stood before the ruins of Tiwanaku all those centuries ago also left later visitors shaking their heads in awe and reverence. But that wasn't all there was to see. Another part of the Tiwanaku complex consists of a series of inexplicable, monster-sized stone blocks known as Pumapunku. They are situated just a few miles southwest of Tiwanaku, and I would like to tell you now, if you ever visit Tiwanaku, don't miss Pumapunku. Don't be put off by any excuses from tired tour guides. Whereas Tiwanaku has, to a small extent, been reconstructed, this is not possible in Pumapunku. The stone platforms are simply too heavy and too huge. Thanks to Horbiger's world ice theory and the racist Nazi philosophies of that time, Pumapunku has been scandalously ignored in the modern archaeological literature. This is how South America's mysterious Pumapunku is treated in one sumptuous anthology, in just a couple of lines of text. In the southwestern corner of Tiwanaku stand the large pyramids known as Pumapunku. Their upper platforms form two flat areas at different heights, both of which can be reached by ascending several flights of steps. On one of the platforms, a temple may have stood, with three large portals built in the style of the Sun Gate. That's not just meager, it's also wrong. Pumapunku was never a pyramid, and doesn't present itself as one today either. and the so-called Sun Gate, well, that's another subject entirely and has nothing to do with the platforms of Pumapunku. I'll get back to that later. In the first half of the 19th century, French paleontologist Alice Charles Victor d'Orbigny, 1802 to 1857, traveled to South America. In 1833, he stood before the ruins of Pumapunku and reported on the mighty portals that stand on horizontal stone slabs. He measured the length of one of the uninterrupted platforms as 131 feet. These days, however, there are no more interconnected slabs. They are all broken, smashed, or simply ravaged by time. Despite the fact that the Bolivian army was still using the slabs at Pumapunku for its target practice right up until the 1940s, the stones that remain are still sufficient to leave you breathless. In 1869, Swiss travel writer Johann Jakob von Schudi stumbled over the ruins of Pumapunku and wrote, "On the way to Pumapunku, we came upon a field with a strange monolith, around 5 feet high and roughly 5.5 feet wide. At its base, it is around 2 feet thick, and at its peak, 1.5 feet. It features two rows of slots or compartments. The monolith is known as El Escritorio, the desk." Whoever it was that dubbed this block the desk, because the various compartments do actually remind you of drawers, was barking up the wrong tree. This block is made of andesite and probably served as a support for stone struts. Even as a specialist in Stone Age mysteries, Pumapunku always leaves me breathless, and I've been there 16 times. This Pumapunku and neighboring Tiwanaku are a panorama of another culture. Mighty blocks of andesite and diorite, a gray-green plutonic rock that is incredibly hard and resistant to weathering, are strewn around. There is absolutely no granite there. The monoliths have been worked with such a precision, honed and polished, as if they had been created in a workshop equipped with modern tools, such as stainless steel milling machines and diamond-tipped drills. Exquisitely precise channels, around a quarter of an inch wide and roughly a third of an inch deep, cut at right angles, something that simply would not be possible with Stone Age tools, run over the diorite monoliths. Nothing here fits in with the image of a primitive Stone Age culture. Pumapunku was witness to some impressive high-tech, and that can be proved. Even before Hans Horberger started harassing the scientific community with his world ice theory, two other German scientists visited Tiwanaku and Pumapunku. Max Uhle, 1856 to 1944, was an archaeologist. He is known as the father of Peruvian archaeology. He met geologist and explorer Alphonse Stubel, 1835 to 1904, at the Royal Zoological and Anthropological Ethnographical Museum in Dresden. The two learned men were soon friends and colleagues, and in 1892 they published an incomparable standard work, Die Ruinenstätte von Tiwanaku im Hochlande des Alten Peru, The Ruins of Tiwanaku in the Highlands of Ancient Peru. This work, which is only to be found in the larger libraries these days and is usually not lent out, is 23 inches tall and 15 inches wide and weighs around 22 pounds. Alphonse Stubel noted the precise measurements that they had made in Tiwanaku and Pumapunku, and the archaeologist Max Uhle carefully collected the entire canon of existing writings on the subject of the mysterious ruins. His text is filled with footnotes, notices, and remarks. Even back then, Tiwanaku lay in ruins. Plundered and cannibalized by robbers and state organizations that transported the perfectly polished blocks off to goodness knows where and used them to build houses. This is where, for example, the entire raw material for the village church in Tiwanaku came from, as well as its enclosure wall and the courtyards all around. Monoliths were smashed, precisely worked blocks were converted, and millennia-old columns were adapted to fit in with the church's architecture. So it's hardly surprising that today's reconstruction work in Tiwanaku is only able to give hints of the site's former glories. Nevertheless, Stubel was able to measure a rectangle 394 feet long from north to south and 371 feet wide east to west. At the front of this rectangle stood a half-broken gateway made of light gray andesitic lava, 9.9 feet high, 12.5 feet wide, and nearly 20 inches thick. It is known today as the Gateway of the Sun. Chiseled into the stone are 48 winged beings, flanking a main figure on the left and right. Max Uhle wrote, "In them, the winged beings, we see the most precious legacy of a long-forgotten epoch in religious history. The mythology in this depiction reveals itself in the wings of the beasts that surround the figure in the middle. And this central figure, too, can be nothing less than some kind of divine being, not least because of the corona surrounding it and the other wondrous signs. It is the sovereign God, to whom homage is being paid by a host of winged heavenly servants. It almost seems as though the frieze running along the bottom was intended to transpose this homage scene from the earth onto a heavenly setting." This spontaneous interpretation of the Sun Gate comes from the year 1877. All of the following academics of that epoch, such as Professor Arthur Poznanski, Dr. Edmund Kiss, and Dr. Hans Schindler Bellamy, analyzed the figures on the Sun Gate and assumed that they represented the most phenomenal calendar in the world. That's another thing I'll come back to later. Stulla and Ulla were astonished by the quality of the stone material used at Tiwanaku and Pumapunku. I quote, "The types of andesite worked here display such a degree of hardness and durability that we must surely categorize them as some of the most difficult of all to work. Bearing in mind the characteristics of the majority of the worked material, we are faced with not only an architectural but also a technical problem here at the site of the ruins. It would seem that the quality of the work here is out of all proportion to the technical means available to the ancient Peruvians." These sentences come from Alphonse Stubel, a geologist by trade and an expert who, we can be fairly sure, was well acquainted with the degree of hardness of the stones. Diorite, for example, a gray-green plutonic rock, has a hardness grade of 8. The hardness grade is a measurement of the resistance of a solid body to being penetrated by another body. The hardness of minerals is measured on the Mohs scale, named after Friedrich Mohs, 1773 to 1839. Any solid material has a lower degree of hardness than a material that can be used to scratch it, and a higher one than any material it can scratch. Take a look at this. Diamonds, the hardest minerals on earth, have a hardness grade of 10. Diamonds cannot be scratched by stones like granite. In order to work diorite with the kind of unbelievable precision that can be seen in Pumapunku, you would need far more advanced tools than just stone axes. The tools that were used must have been at least as hard as, if not harder than, diorite. To maintain anything else is just humbug. Feeble excuses. That's it exactly. There's certainly something rotten in the Kingdom of Denmark. For a start, because of the tools that simply don't fit in with the Stone Age culture, and secondly, because of the complex technical plans that would have been necessary. Honestly, today's archaeology really can't take the risk of looking at the problem because it would open a real can of worms, intentionally. Even back in the age of the Spanish conquistadores, so-called comites were set up that were given the task of systematically destroying everything that alluded to the heathen religion. The priests' fanaticism was insatiable. The comites consisted of people who were familiar with the conditions in the area. Often, the sons of the tribal chiefs and sun priests were forced to join these comites and seek out the ancient shrines. Under the leadership of the Catholic priests, everything was destroyed that was in any way destroyable. It was a systematic erasure of the hated heathen culture. Thousands of statues and temples built by the Inca and from pre-Inca times were smashed, and the rubble was thrown down the mountainside. The only religious symbol that was allowed was the sign of the cross. And when this religious zeal was finally sated, then came the stone plunderers looking for building material for streets, churches, and houses. Maybe the Tiwanaku builders suspected the dangers of blind religious zeal and intentionally left behind a few signs for eternity. Tiwanaku is said to have been built in a single night, according to the chroniclers. It involved unknown builders, unknown tools, and unknown draftsmen. One of the helpful gods was called Viracocha, but Tixivirakocham con Tixivirakocha and Pakayakachik are one and the same figure. According to Stubel and Ula, the word can be separated into its Quechua components. Cocha means sea. Vira is fat or foam. Put it together and you end up with foam sea. Linguistic scientist E.W. Middendorf, who published 4 volumes of the Quechua and Aymara languages around 150 years ago and is recognized as one of the world's great authorities on Indo languages, comes up with another interpretation. He translates Kontiksivirakocha as God of the Liquid Lava Sea. Here, Kon means God, Tixi means lava, and Kocha means sea. Johann Jakob Tschudi translated this correspondingly as sea of the origin and end of all things. Does the name God of the Liquid Lava Sea bring us any closer to the secret of this Viracocha? After Stubel and Ula have paved the way for serious research in Tiwanaku, a number of other scientists from various different faculties picked up on the subject. Around the turn of the century, Tiwanaku and Pumapunku were the very epitome of a world mystery, alongside Egypt, of course. The problem was that Egypt was a lot closer for the British, French, and German archaeologists who preferred to dig around in the desert sands. Very few chose to take the arduous journey to the high Andes of Peru and Bolivia. Let's not forget that Tiwanaku lies at an altitude of some 13,000 feet. The air is thin and the way up is difficult. Today's tourists have it much easier. A jet brings them to La Paz, the capital of Bolivia. From there, it's just an hour and a half on the now fully paved road to Tiwanaku and Pumapunku. The altitude hasn't changed, however, and if you choose to make the trip, don't try to do too much on your first few days. It takes a couple of days for your blood cells to acclimate to the different altitude.